Good afternoon. So, last time we talked. We started by talking a bit about some logistical issues. There's one thing I want to mention again, which is that we'll talk again about on Thursday, but there's a quiz due next Tuesday, which will be released Thursday. Don't want to forget. Then we talked about some things about operating systems. And we started with, what is an operating system? We mentioned, there's not actually consensus on the details of that, that there's some principles people agree apply to what an operating system is, but the specifics are kind of wishy-washy about, is this really an operating system or not? And we had sort of two approaches to figuring out things that were our principles for what an operating system is. And one from our primary textbook had these sort of three roles that things that are operating systems, or at least look like operating systems, play. One was this role of a referee, that we have some resources that are somehow shared, like our processor is shared between multiple things that all want to use it, that we need to decide how that gets shared. They call that role the referee, sort of making decisions about how resources can be accessed and who can do what. Have this role they call the illusionist, which is that, it turns out that using a keyboard with the hardware interface is pretty complicated and awkward, and that we'd like a simpler interface. And that simpler interface is this kind of illusion that the hardware is really simpler than it is, or at least different than it really is. So that's this illusionist role, that we're providing these abstractions that are hopefully better or easier to use than what we really have in the underlying hardware. We also have this glue role. They mentioned that there are things that lots of programs need that we don't want to keep implementing over and over again, like directories. We don't want every single program to have its own implementation of how directories work. So these are all things that sort of would be part of the role of the OS. So Anderson Dahlin took this approach of saying, we look at, are we doing these tasks? And Arpeggio Dassault said, let's look at it from sort of a perspective of kind of this layering of software and say, the OS is creating this kind of virtual machine, that when we write programs, I'm not actually writing a program for the actual hardware. That's not what I have in mind when I'm deciding how my program outputs things or starts or stops. I'm instead writing for this kind of fake machine that the OS makes. And a traditional OS that we're used to using has this particular kind of fake machine we call a process virtual machine. And it has this process abstraction that's what we're used to programming with, and that is designed to be convenient for writing programs and running them alongside each other. And it has many abstractions that kind of are correlate to things on the real machine, but are more capable and at least different. Like we have threads instead of processors. And threads, we can have lots of threads, even if we only have one processor. We have this idea of an address space instead of having to deal with the physical restrictions of the actual memory that might be installed in the underlying hardware. We have this really flexible address space we'll talk about later in the semester, instead of having to worry about how each keyboard, screen, and so on all work, we have this kind of unified interface of files for talking to those things. And from a process's perspective, that's what the machine implements. It doesn't implement hard drives, it implements files, and so on. So after talking about the kind of interface that defines an OS, we started talking a bit about how we might implement an operating system. And I mentioned that, there's kind of something we've settled on for the implementation technique, which requires a bit of help from the hardware. Now, this is not the only way we can make an OS, but it's certainly what you're most likely to come across, and what kind of seems to be the current consensus on sort of what we should do and what we should have the hardware help us with. And there's a couple cases of hardware support that are very important. So one of these is this notion of kernel versus user mode, that the hardware is going to let the OS run code on the processor, but in a restricted fashion that we call user mode. That's not going to have full access to the machine, and that will be limited to this kernel mode. And the operating system, when it wants to let a user program use a processor, can just run it in user mode and not need to worry that it's going to do things that we shouldn't let normal programs do. It's not going to like access devices that we don't want to give it access to, and so on. We also need something about accessing the memory. And the typical current hardware provides what we call address translation, that the memory addresses that a program sees aren't the actual memory addresses in the underlying hardware. Instead, there's some function that maps from one to the other, and the OS can set up that function. And by doing so, it can make different programs have different things in their apparent memory while still letting them run directly on the machine. We can implement this with help from the hardware, which means that we can run the program directly, and it will still see the fake memory addresses, even though it's running on the real processor, because the processor implements this address translation. We'll talk much more about how that address translation works later in the semester. Now, if we're running the user programs directly on the processor, we also need some way for the operating system to run when it's required. And in particular, if we're running user programs in this restricted fashion, we need some way to have the operating system run and not be restricted, even though the processor is currently in a restricted fashion. And our mechanism for running the operating system when needed is called exceptions, and it's going to interact with that user kernel mode restriction by the hardware when an exception happens. It's going to jump to the OS and switch to kernel mode if we aren't in there already. And this allows the operating system to respond to events like key presses or a program taking too long and so on without the program needing to be written with that in mind, and therefore without the OS needing to check that the program is actually going to run the OS when it should. So the hardware will make sure that happens directly. And we also mentioned that if a program wants to do things that require kernel mode that are not part of that restricted subset of the machine, the way they'll do it is they'll trigger an exception to run the OS in kernel mode so it can do it on its behalf, or decline to do it if it's not supposed to be allowed. So questions on these things we covered last time? So a brief aside on exceptions versus mode switches, since this was a point of confusion I saw during office hours. So a mode switch is the name I get from going from kernel to user mode or user to kernel mode. So that's a thing that happens. And there's some confusion about this versus exceptions. And this is understandable because exceptions are very related to mode switches. Pretty much every time we switch from user to kernel mode, it's an exception. The exception is the OS triggering an OS function to run. And if we were just in user mode, yes, that requires switching to kernel mode. Exceptions can also occur in kernel mode. So for example, if I'm handling a system call and someone presses a key, well, handling a system call was an exception. So I'm in the middle of handling an exception. So I'm in kernel mode. Then I press a key. That's another exception. The processor is going to run the OS and say, what do you want to do about this key press? And that's going to be another exception in kernel mode. We're not going to switch to kernel mode because we're already there. And typically, the way we'll switch away from kernel mode, do the mode switch from kernel to user, is finishing an exception handler. And we'll see an example of that later today. But these are, I want to mention this explicitly, since a common point of confusion, people really wanted exceptions and mode switches to be the same thing. But sort of exceptions cause mode switches, but they're not sort of, that's the relationship. Yes?
So the qualifier there, if you're not already in kernel mode, implies that there are some programs that can be running in kernel mode and trigger exceptions while running in kernel mode?
Question is, the qualifier not if all in kernel mode means that we can trigger exceptions while in kernel mode?
Yes.
So there's two kinds of ways this can happen. So one way is that some exceptions come from external events. So like if I press a key or data comes into the network while we're doing something else in kernel mode, that'll trigger an exception.
Okay. And
sometimes the OS will handle that exception right away. The other example is that code in kernel mode can do so these sort of unexpected things where the processor will ask for help. So like code in kernel mode could divide by zero. That will trigger an exception. Code in kernel mode could access memory that's invalid. That will trigger an exception. That answer your question?
Yeah.
Yes?
Do all exceptions force a mode switch?
Question, do all exceptions force a mode switch? So I will teach it as we always go to kernel mode and an exception. On x86, that might technically not be true, but I don't think the exceptions ever come up in practice. Yes? So the question is, what happens if kernel mode code triggers one of these fault exceptions, like dividing by zero or accessing invalid memory? Well, the processor is going to try to run the exception handler. And if that works, the exception handler will handle the situation. So one example of what you might do is you might display an error message. That's a common thing. So if you know what seen a kernel panic or like a blue screen of death, that's the sort of thing that happens on those events, typically. Now, you might have a situation which is more unfortunate where like you're trying to handle that exception and another exception happens. So usually there's some point where the hardware, either you'll have a loop and your system won't be very operable, or you'll trigger some sort of hardware failsafe. So for example, on x86, if you have an invalid memory access, the processor distinguishes whether you're already handling an invalid memory access. So it has what's called a double fault exception for an invalid memory access while trying to recover from an invalid memory access. And then there's something called a triple fault, where if you have another exception in that, and the action that the process x86 has decided, Intel decided way back to take, is reboot the machine. And processors might make other decisions like that. It depends on what the hardware manufacturer thinks makes sense. Answer your question? Yeah. Question? Does a system call trigger an exception? Yes, and we'll talk about that much more later. Other questions? Okay. Okay, so I think I mentioned we'll be using XV6. So based on 6th edition units, I mentioned this earlier, running on 32-bit x86, we have some instructions on setting it up. And the first assignment is going to be adding two system calls to XV6. And it also includes XV6 download instructions and includes instructions that should work on M1 Max, where you can't set up a x86 Linux VM easily, and seem to have worked for several students. Might have to debug some special cases for that. If that doesn't work, I can get you a remote environment, but I would prefer not to do that because I think I have limited hardware and it's probably not super fast. And there's also an XV6 book, which is a very, very detailed description of what everything does. So you'll need a Linux environment or some non-Linux environments to get this to work. And we're going to use QEMU. QEMU is an emulator, so it's kind of like VirtualBox, except it doesn't actually work by running things directly. It does something kind of more like a Java virtual machine to run the code, which means it's a lot more portable. It also means that you can attach GDB to it, which might come up to be handy, which is a little harder to do for like VirtualBox. So the first assignment to do it is to, get XV6 compiled and working and, add some system calls. We'll talk about how system calls work in XV6 in great detail today, so it should make the assignment more straightforward. So XV6, it has a Unix-like design. So it has a Unix-like kernel, which implements a very small set of system calls. You might look at the list and say, wait a minute, there's like 24 of them. That's not very small, and I assure you that's very small. Like Linux is like a couple hundred. And it's less featureful than traditional Unix. So for example, exit on traditional Unix takes an exit status. On XV6, we'll see it takes nothing. It has a user space library. So it has a standard library. The standard library has some of the functionality you might be used to, but it's very limited because it's small and they have to write it all. And it has some simple programs. It has a command line, something to run other programs called a shell, which we'll talk much more about later. It has like ls, makedir, echo to print something to the screen, cat to output a file, and some self-testing programs. So I mentioned echo here. Echo is a program which you type echo something like, echo foo bar, and it will output foo bar. So that's the echo program. Well, let's look at the source code for the echo program in XV6. So some of this should look familiar. So some of the things will look different, like the header files we include are a bit different. And we have this loop here. We have argc and argv. So if you vaguely remember from 2150, when I think this was very briefly mentioned, the way arguments are passed in C traditionally is argc is the number of arguments, and argv is an array of strings. The first element of the array is the name of the program being run, which would be echo in this case. And the other elements are the arguments. And this is a loop which uses printf with a format string that specifies a string, which is this argv of I, and another string, which is this expression, which will either resolve to a space or a new line. So it prints argument, space, then a new argument, new line. You might say, wait a moment, but what about this first argument to printf here? So XV6's printf doesn't work like the printf you're used to. And this would be, if we were using something that wasn't XV6, this would be more like fprintf standard out dot dot dot. That's what the printf1 is kind of equivalent to. So the 1 is a number for standard out, and you have to specify it, and they decided to call it printf instead of fprintf, which might have been less confusing if you're used to writing code in C. So another thing you'll notice is that rather than returning from main, we just call exit, and exit takes no arguments. And you might say, well, we could have just returned from main, right? And the answer is not exactly. If you just return from main, the program will crash when it finishes rather than exiting, because on XV6, nothing calls main. So on Linux, when you have a program, something has called main. There's some code the compiler provides which calls main. So you can return from main to that code, and that code exits. On XV6, there's no code that's called main. Main is where the operating system started running your program. And since nothing called main, when you try to return, you try to pop a return address from the stack, there's nothing there, and you're going to jump to some bogus memory location and trigger a crash. So that's why we have a call to exit. Okay, so questions about our echo program. Okay. And so in the interest of demoing XV6, So when you unpack XV6, you'll get a directory with files like this. You can see we have our echo.c that I just showed you, and a bunch of other files that you can look at your leisure, and the XV6 book should describe what's in them all. And I can run sort of make to build everything, compile everything. Takes a bit. And then I'm going to use, so make qmu would run the emulator in a separate window. I'm going to run make qmu-no-x to run it in the same window, because that would show up better for this demo. And you can see that it shows that it's booting, says it's starting, and I get a shell prompt, which we have a shell. We have an ls command. So ls command is maybe a lot less featureful than the one you're used to. It prints out a fixed format rather than having that be flexible. We have our echo command. Works like so. And there's also a nice shutdown command. Okay. Okay, so questions about using XV6? Yes?
If you were a keyboard interrupt inside of that shell, would the shell handle it, or would...
So the question is, what happens if I do a keyboard interrupt, by which meaning like Control C?
Yeah.
Okay. So I believe, I'm not sure, but I don't think XV6 has special handling for Control C. So it's just a key. I think there's special handling for Control P as it happens, but I'd have to like read the code to figure that out exactly which has special, but I don't think there's any special handling for it. So the shell would just read a Control C character. Other questions? Okay, so let's go on to our primary topic for today, which is going to be talking about how system calls work in XV6. So here I have an XV6 program that prints hello world to the screen without using printf, using what might seem like a system call directly. So this function here is going to turn into one system call. And we have three arguments. So the first argument is where to write to. So it's called write. It writes. First argument is where to write to. One that means standard out. The second argument is the data to write. And the third argument is how long that data is in bytes. So this is writing hello world to standard out. And this is a function call. And that function call goes to a standard library function. And that's what actually is going to make a system call. Now, it happens that this standard library function basically only makes a system call. It doesn't do any other work, like printf does a lot of other stuff. This only makes a system call. So there's a system call that this corresponds directly to, and we'll look at what that is. So what's going to happen is we're going to have this function call, calls our standard library function, and our standard library function contains a special instruction to trigger an exception. We can't have that happen on the function call directly because, well, a normal function call shouldn't trigger an exception. Right? If we think of calling like a function in our program, that should happen without the OS getting involved normally. So it needs to have something special, and it happens to have assembly code. We'll see how this works exactly, which runs this special instruction, which just happens to be what XV6 has chosen to be the way you trigger exceptions for system calls. There were other options XV6 could choose from. They chose this instruction. So this triggers an exception. And that exception goes through the hardware to the interrupt table. So the interrupt table is basically an array of all the OS code that the hardware can jump to. And it says which one do we have for this kind of exception? So the hardware calls some OS code, and that runs some code in the kernel, and that's going to eventually return. This is what I forgot to remove. Return back to our system call wrapper. So we're going to look in a lot more detail about what the code in the kernel does, and also talk a little bit about exactly how that function looks. Yes? Question is the interrupt table the same thing as an interrupt handler? No. So the interrupt table is basically a table of pointers to the interrupt handlers. And the interrupt handler is the code that the hardware actually jumps to. Yes? Question is the interrupt table the same as the exception table? Yes. I'm just using the name that is closer to what the x86 documentation uses. Okay, so here's a diagram with our components in the actual kernel. Something I'll note from a high level that's going to come up a bit later is that we have the code on the top, the user program and the system call wrapper. That runs in user mode and uses a stack made for user mode. And the code in yellow is going to all run in kernel mode and all going to use a stack made for kernel mode. And the hardware on x86 handles switching stacks on some other platforms. Maybe you'd have to do that in software. But XV6 has this design where we use a different stack in kernel mode versus user mode. And we'll look at this later. Okay, so let's first look at this system call wrapper. So this is the thing which actually triggers a system call. And we have our call to write and main. And the system call wrapper is written in assembly. It can't be written in pure C because we can't write the special instruction that actually runs a system call in C. Now, we have some sort of special constants, and these are just choices that XV6 made. So XV6 decided that we're going to identify writes with the number 16. They just chose a number for every type of system call. And they decided that all system calls are going to be identified by the exception type 64. That's just a number, and it happens to be passed to the int instruction on x86. They have this idea that you'll trigger different types of exceptions for different operations you want the OS to use. As we'll see, XV6 has basically decided to not use that functionality, but they have to choose one number, so they chose 64 to choose a number. So we have our special instruction, which triggers an exception, and the parameter says the type of exception, as in like what entry in the exception table the program would like to run. We'll see how that's set up later. And we also specify the type of system call it is by coding it in EEX. This is just something XV6 chose to do. As we'll see later, XV6 is basically just going to read back the value that was put in EEX when it used to make a decision about how to handle this system call. There's nothing the hardware is doing to say you have to use this way of determining what to do. It was just convenient to use EEX for this purpose. Now, if you actually open up usys.s, you won't actually see this code here. Instead, you'll see some macros, some preprocessor macros, like you might see in C. So the code you'll see in usys.s, you know, has this define syscall to mean something and then syscall write. And this is because they need to write these system call wrappers for all these different system calls, and they didn't want to like write out the assembly all by hand, so they just have sort of a template that you generates them on demand. And the .S means an assembly file that goes through the C preprocessor. So the assembler actually sees this expanded version, and that's part of compiling it sort of to an object file produces that. So questions about what our system call wrapper does? Okay, not seeing any. Okay, so I mentioned we had this instruction that triggers an exception, and it specifies what trap type of exception it wants to trigger, and it actually specifies an index into the exception table it wants to use, and that's going to determine how the hardware figures out what to run, and we're going to run this assembly function, which is called vector64. It's called vector64 because it handles the exception with number 64, and it turns out that XV6 has generated one of these functions for every possible type of exception, so that actually has 256 of them, again generated by a program because they didn't want to write that by hand. And to make that work, we have to set up the interrupt table, also sometimes known as the exception table, or the full name you'll read in Intel's manuals is the interrupt descriptor table. And to do this, there's some code that XV6 runs at boot that sets this up. So they have in their C code an array IDT of table entries. And you might say, oh, this is a table of function pointers because we need to point to just the code to run. And on some platforms, that would be true. X86 stores a bit of extra information in the table. So in addition to storing the pointer to the function to run, there's some extra data the processor uses, we'll see in a bit, which makes it more complicated. So the first thing the XV6 does is it runs the LIDT, which stands for load interrupt descriptor table instruction, to tell the processor, hey, my interrupt descriptor table, as x86 calls it, is here. Please use that in the future when exceptions happen. and then asks to set entries in this table. And because the entries have a particular format, they're like kind of a struct in the hardware, they have this macro set gate, which handles setting, you know, filling in the entry the way the hardware expects it to be formatted. And this call a set gate, well, it takes the entry to fill in. So in this case, this is the entry with the index 64. That's the number they've assigned to system calls. And we make it point to the vector 64 function. And in the code that does this, they just have an array called vectors, which has a pointer to vector 0, 1, 2, up to 255. So they have vector 64 pointer. So they assign that, and they have to set a bit of extra metadata. And I'll just mention what this metadata is. We're not going to test on this, but just so you can understand what's going on in XV6. So it turns out that, you know, normally we don't allow you to just run a particular exception, because it, you know, wouldn't be good for users to be able to like trigger a keyboard interrupt if there's not actually a key press. So you can mark these table entries in x86 as being something that can be triggered by this special int instruction and something which can't. And so this flag DPL user says, please let this be triggered from the int instruction. If that wasn't there and we ran the same int instruction, well, it would still trigger an exception, but it would be the kind of permission denied exception. It would be the exception for something like the program doing a divide by zero, same kind of issue. We'd still run the OS, but it wouldn't run it in the same way. We also need to, on x86, say that when this exception happens, I want you to run the vectors code in kernel mode. It turns out that that's not the only option on x86, even though on most other platforms it would be the only option. So this is setting up that code to run in kernel mode. And there's an extra flag to say that, yes, this can be triggered by something like int in general. And that's what that one is there. Okay, so we set this table entry. We set all the metadata to say that, yes, this is one, a special table entry, one triggered by the int instruction and not just, you know, for whatever the raw event is. And we have our code for vector 64. And you can see that it doesn't actually do much itself. It kind of delegates to this generic trap handling code. So vector 64 just saves two values on the stack. Most notably, it saves 64 on the stack. So you can remember that this was exception type 64. This was a system call later on. And then we jump to this code, which is common for every single type of exception. So XV6 has basically decided that, yeah, it's nice that the hardware lets me have a separate handler for each kind of exception, but I really wanted just one handler. So they just jump to this one handler, which is going to save all the registers somewhere, and then call this trap function, where this trap frame is just a pointer to all the saved registers. So everything that was happening before the exception happened. So that's what we end up with, and we're going to call that trap function from this common code. And the code that you'll see for most of the other exceptions is pretty much the same. It's something like that. So all the exceptions work the same way, except we just have this different number that's stored based on the index. And this is just basically XV6 saying, didn't really care for the idea of having separate handlers for each exception, but they still need to figure out what type of exception it is for later. Yes?
Yeah, so trap ASM is like common for all handles, all traps, right?
Yeah.
All traps, but trap.c is also like common for...
Question is, trap ASM is common for all of them. Is trap.c also common? Yes. So it's the same C function that's called for all of them. So the question is then, what does this trap function do? So the trap function is going to use that saved trap number to figure out what to do. And in this case, there's a unique number for all system calls. So there's some code in trop that says, oh, if the save trop number, which is in my argument, that trap frame struct, is the one for a system call, then I'm going to actually do the work for a system call. Now, this trap frame struct, we see it contains the save trap number. It also contains, which will be important later, the save value of all the registers. So if we went to like figure out what the registers were, or just because we need to save them to restore them later, that's where they're going to be. And we use some funny things in here. So we have this myproc. So as we'll talk about when we talk about how processes work more generally, this is kind of like a global variable that represents the currently running process. The reason, main reason it's not actually a global variable is that XV6 supports multi-core, so what the currently running process is will be different depending what core you're on. And you can see what we do is we check if the currently running process actually, you know, is supposed to be keep running or whether it's been killed for some reason. For example, you know, some other program decided to get rid of it or something. And then we save a copy of the registers of the program inside the process information, and we run this syscall function. We don't pass any arguments to it. It's going to figure out from the current process in that swap frame what to do. So it's going to figure out how to handle the syscall. It just knows there's a syscall, and well, we saved all the information about the running program in this trap frame. They're just going to look at that to figure out what the program wanted to do. Okay, so questions? Yes? So question is, why do we check if my process is killed twice? So most notably, if the system call is exit, we want to actually do that. And it could have been, it could be the case that like a program made a system call and then something else ran that made the, so the program should be killed. Like you ran a command to kill the program. We need to handle that. Yes? Question, why do we exit instead of return? So exit is a function that does the work of switching to another program. That answer your question? Other questions? Okay. So we have our syscall function, and it's going to use the saved value of EAX. So remember, our syscall wrapper, in addition to running the special instruction, it put a number that meant write in EAX. And here's where we're going to finally read that number and figure out what we actually want to do. So syscall.c has the implementation of this main syscall function. And we have this big array of function pointers, and I probably should be careful talking about this because this is probably confusing, because it turns out that C has made some poor syntax choices. So this is how you declare an array of pointers to functions that return an int and take no arguments. That's what this is. So syscalls is an array of pointers to functions. And there's this nice syntax here, you see, where rather than just specifying element 0, 1, 2, 3, you can specify an index in brackets followed by an element, and that fills in that index, which means you can have like gaps. And this also means that like if you change what syswrite is, what index it is, it will still be in the syswrite element of the array, no matter what that is. So this is how the array is set up. So it says that the syswrite, remember, is the number for the write system call, which we learned happened to be 16. That's just what they arbitrarily chose, corresponds to the function called syswrite, which we'll see later. And this code down here is what runs it. So we retrieve from that trap frame we saved earlier the value of EAX that was saved by the assembly code that ran right after the exception happened. And we check that it's in range and that there's actually a system call with that index. And if so, we just call that function. And the return value of that function we store as the new save value of EX, because we know later on we're going to return from this system call and this whole exception, and we're going to restore all the registers that were there before. So we just change the value of EAX to restore to a new value. That's how we return using EAX from the system call. Now, something you may notice is that, wait, we aren't passing any arguments to this system call function, so how are they going to get? We're going to see that later. The function we call is going to be responsible for getting the arguments. It's not going to be done for it. Other questions? Yes? Question, isn't there 24 system calls? That probably, I don't actually have it memorized. The syntax supports like having gaps. So you could like have a system call with number 100 and add it to the array, and things would work without doing anything that doesn't follow the current pattern. Other questions? Okay, so we have our syswrite function being run, and it's going to have to get its arguments. And where are we going to get those arguments? Well, when we called write, we had to put the arguments somewhere. And the way it works on 32-bit x86, without us doing anything extra, happens to be that the arguments are on the user stack. On a different platform, maybe it would be in some other place, but they happen to be on the user stack. And the XV6 designers said, well, if they're already there, I'm not going to have us do extra work to like move the arguments somewhere else. We're just going to have them be where they would be from the call to write, and we're just going to find them on the stack. So if we look at the implementation of syswrite, which is in sysfile.c, so in XV6, the system call implementations are in sysfile.c for the file-based ones, and sysproc.c for basically the other ones. And we have this call to these bunch of these arg functions. So these arg functions, they look at the currently running program, and they read from its stack the argument with an appropriate index. The index of the argument is passed as the first argument here. So we get the file descriptor from argument 0. We get the number of elements from argument 2. This is a zero-based index, so it's the third argument. And we get the data from argument 1, the second argument, which is of length n. And this not only retrieves the arguments, but it also, you know, checks for some error scenarios. You might say, wait a moment, how could there be an error here? So the most obvious case is, well, the pointer could point somewhere that doesn't make sense. But there's other things that could be wrong. So for example, a user program could mess up their stack pointer and then trigger a system call. And we need to make sure that we handle that by doing something other than like crashing the kernel. Like, we can crash the program, we can't crash all the programs. And this code, our code, checks for those sorts of scenarios. So questions about this general setup? Okay. And you can see that this write system call implementation, after it retrieves the arguments, it just delegates to the actual internal implementation of writing through a file. So to be more specific about how the arguments work, in the 32-bit x86 calling convention, this write call turns into some code something like this, which pushes the arguments on the stack, probably in what you might call reverse order. So the idea is that when we pop an argument, we get the first one, because that's most convenient when you're implementing something like printf, where like you need to get the next argument a lot. Probably like that. And that means that if we look at the stack, that, you know, when we're entering write, the stack pointer is going to point to a return address because of what the call instruction does. And then we have the arguments above it. And so what the code in those arg functions does is it reads the save stack pointer. So when we call the trap function, we save the old stack pointer from before the exception. So it reads that value and does some math to get the argument with the appropriate index. Okay, so questions about how we can retrieve these arguments? clear. So this is here, this is tf-esp. Okay. So that's our write system call being done. And then we have some final steps where we need to go back to the user program. So we return from syswrite, returns from syscall, returns from trap. And then we have a bit of assembly that was at the end of all traps. So that's going to restore those save registers. And we might have changed some of them. That's fine. We'll restore the change values. And then it's going to run a special instruction called return from interrupt on x86. It happens to be iret. It's the instruction that's used that's going to cause the hardware to switch stacks and go back to user mode. Some questions about our restoring process. Okay, so that's our... interesting. So that's our overall process. So questions about this overall? Okay. Yes? So where are the arguments saved to the stack? That is done as part of calling write. So give this example, like this code here will compile on 32-bit x86 to something like that. Does that answer your question? So if we're on 64-bit x86, which might be part of the confusion here, it would put the arguments in registers instead. It's just a difference between 32 versus 64 bits usual calling convention. Does that make sense? 64-bit x86 typically uses registers for this, rather than using the stack, which is most common on 32-bit. If it used registers, that would also be fine. We just need to read the arguments from the same registers instead of the stack. Other questions? Question, what value to put in EAX? The return value of the system call. So for the write system call, it turns out the return value is how many bytes were written. And there's some other system calls where the return value might be more obvious than that. Other questions? Okay. So I mentioned we have our first homework. So let's get familiar with XP6. You need to add two new system calls, which is part of why we went into detail about how system calls work. So one is called write count, which is going to need to return the number of times write was called. Probably you're going to implement this by adding code to the write system call to increment a counter, and then adding this new system call, which returns the value of that counter. We also want a new system call that takes an argument called set write count, which is going to change the value of that counter to just make it start at a particular place. So my recommendation is start by writing syswrite count, do something similar to sysuptime. So sysuptime counts how many time units the system has been up, so it does something very similar, which might be nice to look at, and add write count to several tables and lists. For figuring out where to add things, I recommend for system calls, like, look at where uptime is. So I like doing a text search and see if you found all the places that it needs to be entered, all the files that it comes up in. And in addition to making the system calls, we also want you to make a program that calls them so you know that they work. Otherwise, I don't know how you know that they work. So I look at what existing programs do and so on. And do the same thing for setRightCount, which needs to take an argument. So we advise, like, syskill takes one integer argument, so it's a good example for what does that look like. A note is that some of the code you'll look at uses locks. So calls acquire and release, and this is related to handling multiple cores. What if two programs are, like, trying to write at the same time? We're going to talk about these issues later in the semester, We're not going to be testing on multi-core, and yes, it's true that in some corner cases, not doing this will cause your behavior to be slightly different. We're not going to worry about it. So you don't have to worry do this. This is primarily a multi-core thing, and we're not going to be handling that yet. So questions about the XP6 intro assignment? Yes?
Does it come out Friday, or is it released right now?
The question, does it come out Friday? It should be marked as not tentative today. You should know everything you need to know to do it. Other questions? Okay. So one thing I mentioned briefly is that we have this user mode code runs using the user stack, and we have this kernel mode code that runs using the kernel stack. On x86, it happens that the hardware switches stacks. Some other platforms, that might not be true. But this design strategy of having a separate stack for user code and kernel code is very common. And is what XV6 does and what a lot of real OSs do. And now that we've sort of gone through how system calls work, let's do a little exercise. So here is an example of doing a read of one character from standard in an XV6 using the read system call. So what the C code might look like works very similarly to write, except we pass a pointer to fill in instead of a pointer to write out. So this is going to call a sysread function inside the system call implementation, if you remember for here, like the bottom here that actually does the work. That's going to be sysread for this. And my question is, when that just starts running, where is the character C, the pointer to C, the return address of the read function, and the first address that's going to be executed in user mode when this after the syscall finishes, where are all those pieces of information stored, or are they not stored? I'll give you a minute or two to go over that. Check with your neighbor, see if you agree and what should happen. Question? The question is, when I say the first address executed user mode after the syscall returns, yes. So where we return to when we finish being in kernel mode?
Thank you.
Okay, who'd like some more time? Okay, so let's start with a character C. Who thinks it's on the user stack? A. Okay, some people. Ooh, who thinks on the kernel stack? Who thinks it's in hardware registers? Who thinks it's now stored elsewhere? Who thinks it's not stored at all? Okay, so this part of the question, the syscall is kind of a red herring. So if I just gave you, if I just called this function foo and said it was a normal C function and asked you where C was stored, you'd probably say, well, it's either, it's a local variable, so either it's on the stack or it's in a register or it was optimized away. Now, probably it can't be optimized away because we take a pointer to it. And since we take a pointer to it, it also can't be in a register because we can't take a pointer to a register. So it has to be on the stack, and it has to be put on the stack when this is not running as part of the kernel, so it has to be on the user stack. Okay, so questions on that answer? Okay, so let's try the pointer to C. That's the argument to read. Who thinks, A, it's on the user stack? People. B, it's on the kernel stack. C, it's in the hardware registers. D, it's somewhere else, but still stored. And E, it's not stored at all. Okay, so plurality answer is the kernel stack. So the kernel stack has our saved registers. If we think of what I showed you for how this function gets called, that when we call it, we're going to do the same kind of thing we did with write, and we're going to have our pointer to C be placed on the stack as part of the 32-bit x86 calling convention. And in order to find it, we're going to have to use the save stack pointer to find it. Now, if it was stored in a register, if the argument was stored in the register instead, then it would be stored on the kernel stack. But because it's stored on the stack in 32-bit x86, the answer is, in fact, the user stack. But if this were something that worked more like 64-bit x86, where we traditionally put arguments in registers, yes, B would be the right answer. But given how xv6 works, it's going to be A. So this is A because it's a local variable. This is A because of the 32-bit calling convention. So questions on that answer? Yes?
So what's the point of having the pointer to C if the character C is also on the stack?
Question, what's the point of having the pointer to C if the character C is also on the stack? Because in our system call implementation, all we know is that it's the second argument. We don't know that the second argument's going to point to the stack, and a lot of the time it won't. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay. So how about the return address of the read function? Thinks A, it's on the user stack. Couple people. Who thinks B, it's on the kernel stack? Okay. Who thinks C, it's in a hardware register? Thinks D, it's somewhere else. Thinks E, it's not stored at all. Okay, so this is another function where the system, another question where the system call is kind of a red herring. If I just replace the read function with a function called foo that didn't make a system call, the answer would be, oh, it's where we put return addresses in general, which on x86, the call instruction pushes it on the stack, so it would have to be on the user stack. So this is same as normal function call. So questions on that answer? Yes?
I have a question about the previous one. So you said that for like an x86, the answer would be B, right?
So question, I said that for the point, for the argument C, pointer to C argument, that in 64-bit x86, I said the answer would be more likely be B, because the way we call the function is we'd like put the pointer to C in RSI, and then RSI would be saved in the truck frame. Does that answer your question? But it happens that the way we pass the arguments on 32-bit x86 is that we don't put them in a register, we put them on the stack. So there's this extra indirection. Okay, other questions, including about our return address of read just being on the stack? Yes?
What does the last thing say after pointer to C, A, 32-bit?
32-bit calling convention. I will try writing that more. Convention. So different calling convention, it would end up in a different place, possibly in the truck frame. Okay. So how about the first address executed in user mode after system call run? So where basically we return from the exception to. So who thinks A, it's on the user stack? Thinks B, it's on the kernel stack. Thinks C, it's in some sort of hardware register. Thinks D, it's somewhere else. Thinks E, it's not actually stored anywhere. Okay, so we have a lot of reluctant answers. And this is the one where you probably don't actually have enough information. But it happens that this is part of the trap frame, and we need this information to execute the return from exception instruction. So the all traps code that runs before call trap is called saves it and then uses it later to run the return from interrupt instruction. So that's our answers. Questions about any part of this? Yes? This question, is there a reason why I want to go back to the system?
Is that like the next instruction?
So the question is, why the return address of read and the first address executed after the system call runs are different?
Tom is asking, is there ever a reason to, instead of going to the next instruction after the system call, you want to go back to the same line of the system call, or would that just create an infinite?
The question is, would I ever want to return not to the instruction after the int instruction that triggered a system call, but to the same one, not for a system call, generally. There are other exceptions where that's going to end up being the case, and it's going to turn out that the hardware decides what version of the program counter to save according to the type of exception, generally in the right way, so we don't need to do extra work. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yeah. Question, where is that address that we return to in user mode stored? It's part of the trap frame, because it's something we need to save in order to use later to execute the return from exception instruction. That answer your question? Other questions? This exercise. Okay, so we've talked a bit about user stacks, and we're going to look at that in more detail. So first, some general notes about them. So I mentioned we have this address translation. So we have this some mapping set up where we have the addresses the program uses, and those are going to map to different things. So like if I put in 100 here, maybe in program A it maps to program A's code, and in program B it maps to program B's code, which will be different places in real memory. Now we also have to have our OS code, our kernel code, in this mapping, and what XV6 chooses to do is that if I put in certain addresses, I probably should use a different color. So if I put in like some address that corresponds to OS data, it's going to correspond to the same place in every process. So what that looks like from sort of this is a diagram from the XV6 book, is that our left side here depicts the addresses you can use from programs. So those are virtual addresses before that translation. And sort of we have our mapping would go in between here. And the top half of the addresses are marked such that the processor will deny access to them if you're not in kernel mode. And those are mapped to the same physical addresses the same way in every single process. So no matter what process you are running, those all map to the same way. And in fact, they map in a really simple way that the first address in this blue region maps to address 0, the next one maps to address 1, and so on. There's just one-to-one mapping for the kernel code. But that's only accessible in kernel mode. If you're in user mode, you're using these green addresses, which are going to be mapped differently in every application. Does that make sense? Questions? Okay. Now, I mentioned that there's a kernel stack. So the user stack we see is here, and it's going to map to some address in here. The kernel stack is allocated here, and the processor handles switching stacks and all that, as we mentioned. So part of the exception handling in x86 is that it does that for the OS. On some other platforms, the OS might have to do it itself. But x86, it's managed by the processor. And the processor saves the stack pointer in a special special location for the processor to know what where it should handle an exception. And x86 actually allocates lots of kernel stacks. So every single process has its own kernel stack. So there's a kernel stack for every single thread the user has. And in x86, every process has exactly one thread. And as part of switching from one thread to another, one user thread to another, XV6 changes what thread should be used for an exception handler by just changing that pointer the processor uses. This is something it changes, like in addition to changing like the active address space, that translation mapping. So we have our stacks there, and the kernel, like all those memories shared, remember, so like we have global variables. These are really global. Like they're shared between every application because it's all the same. So this idea that we have a separate stack, we have lots of stacks, one for each process, and each thread, in fact, is a very common design decision. So a lot of OSs you'll use, probably most of them, use this design. But it's not the only option. And probably the main advantage of it is that it makes writing system calls easier. We can like have our system call handler like put stuff on the stack, and maybe we switch to some other stack when we're not handling that system call. But there are other designs which don't do this, where we have like one stack per core. And the disadvantage of that is that we need to like, instead of having our global variables, our local variables be only for like one particular program, now we have to like figure out which program are we dealing with now and have like separate and have like a lookup in our variables. So most people use this one stack per program, and that's what we're gonna learn because that's what XV6 uses, and that's what pretty much every OS you ever used probably does. But there's some big disadvantages. One big one that's very noticeable in XV6, is that it uses a lot more space. In XV6, the stacks in the kernel are 4 kilobytes. So that means that when you start a process, you're going to have 4 extra kilobytes of memory that the process can't even use directly. Like it's used to handle exceptions while the process runs. But that's just extra memory that you have to allocate. And one other thing, so at the beginning of lecture, we had some questions about, oh, wait a moment, you said that exceptions can happen in kernel mode. You might say, how does this work with the kernel stack? And you might think, wait a moment, won't we go back to the beginning of the stack? Well, the processor in x86 keeps track of whether we've already switched to the kernel stack or not. So basically, if like you have a system call and then there's a key press in the middle, the key press will use the stack above the system call stack. So we'll be on the same stack, and the stack needs to be big enough to handle like everything happening after another and all the local variables for that. Okay, so questions on kernel stacks and there being multiple of them? Okay, so one reason I'm talking about having different kernel stacks for every process right now is that an interesting thing to wonder about is going to be how we deal with running multiple programs. And as we'll learn, that the way we handle switching between programs is going to be very related to these multiple stacks. But first, before we finish up sort of mostly talking about exceptions, I want to talk about the other types of exceptions. So we have a couple other types of exceptions, and they're all handled in trap. So I mentioned all the exceptions go to the trap function. We handle them all the same way. Even though the processor really wanted us to write separate functions for them, we basically just wrote one and made it work with the processor's design to be different. So let's look at how they're handled. So you might say, what about like accessing invalid memory or divide by zero? So that's going to have a trap number that's not for a system call. And in the trap function, there's this big switch statement. And the default case, which will handle things like divide by zero, kills the program, marks as killed, and prints out a message about it. And the message has some useful information, including like which trap triggered it. Like, so there's a number for divide by zero, a number for out of bounds memory access, and so on. So that's their equivalent of dealing with seg faults. That's where that code is in XV6. We also have to deal with IO. So like key presses happen. So, and like you have to get data on the disk. So if you look in the trap function, there's a bunch of cases for IO. IDE is the type of hard drive interface that QEMU implements. So that IDE intercode is for handling data being read in from the disk. We also have a keyboard and a serial port, which historically you could plug in an external terminal with a keyboard and monitor through this serial port interface. That's what that implements. And we're going to talk much later in the semester about what does this IDE inter keyboard inter function do. But the important thing is we dispatch to a handler for dealing with the device, the keyboard, or the disk. We also have to run this function, this LAPICEIO function is something that tells the hardware, hey, I handled this piece of input. Please don't tell me about it anymore. If we don't run that, the hardware might trigger the same exception again, even though there's no new input. So that another important one is timer interrupts. So I mentioned when we talked about like one reason we needed exceptions is that we didn't want to let a program like run an infinite loop forever. We want to stop it. So XV6 sets up a timer to go off periodically at boot, and that triggers an exception. And you can see that exception handled in trap frame, and it's called the timer. And there's two pieces to it. So there's a piece that increments a counter, which is basically keeping track of time. And it also runs this wake up function. And wake up basically implements part of the sleep call. So sleep makes the program stop running for some amount of time. Wake up handles the making it start again part of that. And more commonly, we have this code here, which says if, while this exception was happening, I was running a program, then let's yield, and yield is switch to a different program, if there is one to switch to. Okay, so questions on switch here. Okay. So that's timer interrupt, and we're going to talk next about a lot about how the context switch works. And sort of the idea is that this is how we achieve what's called time multiplexing, that we're going to have one processor, and it can only run one thing at a time, but we're going to simulate running multiple things by switching rapidly between them. So it will look like SSH and Firefox are running at the same time, when in fact, all that's happening is that they're running one after another, and the processor is running the operating system in between. The operating system is doing the work of setting up SSH to run instead of Firefox or my long computation or so on, using exceptions. And in order for this to work, the OS needs to save what we call a context. So it saves program counter and register values information about what was running. And our context is basically all the registers, program counter value, and also information about the address space. And what's going to happen is we're running one program. It's going to have its context on the processor, while the other program has it stored in the OS memory. And then we're going to switch to the other program, and it's going to have its values on the CPU, and we're going to save the first program in its memory. And you might say, so where are we saving this? Where can we see this, say, in XV6? And in XV6, we've actually seen where these contexts are saved. It is that trap frame, that structure with all the register values that's passed to trap. That is where it's saved. That is actually the context. So we've actually seen how the registers are saved because we just say, oh, to handle exceptions, I need to save all the registers. So it's already done, and that's where it's done. And we'll talk more about next time about how that we use that to actually do the whole context switch, you know, bootstrapping from that idea that, oh, we already save all the registers, let's take advantage of that. That's where I'll finish up today.